Salutations, applications, and welcome back to a new episode of the Awesome Friday Podcast, where I start every episode by trying to make Simon laugh. My name is Matthew, and I'm your host, and we're going to talk about two movies today, as is the thing we do on this podcast. But before we dive into either Rebel Moon or Civil War, how are you today, Simon? How are things in the Simonverse?
I'm good. And it's been a difficult week. Lots of work and lots of kids and my wife's been sick and blah, blah, blah. But the most important thing is I've got adult money. And so now this isn't a video podcast, but I just want to display to Matt, like, the length. Here we go. Now you can't see what I'm holding here, but what I'm holding is a giant Godzilla toy that not only makes this sound.
Sound.
And when it walks, it makes this sound. Wrong button. But if you're a Godzilla fan, I'm going to press a button, and the things that light up do light up.
And just for the record, it's currently breathing smoke. It's ridiculous.
There's an atomizer. You put water droplets in the head, and there's an atomizer. And when it growls, it does this little hip twirl thing, and red light projects behind this atomizer. This is the coolest thing I've ever bought in my life. It's huge. My dog is terrified of it. It's amazing. I love it. Even my wife loves it, which you don't believe. She cradled this thing like a baby. And because you can make it walk left and right, and it does that. It's quite clever that you can twist the tail left or right and it controls the direction it walks in. So you can make it effectively wag its tail. And so I wagged its tail while my wife cradled it. And she actually asked, she said, you know, if you want, you can put it in the bedroom on a shelf right over here. She has never said that about any of the stupid shit that I've bought.
So I'm just going to chime in here and I'm going to say, for the record, I don't believe you about it. I don't believe you at all.
I can see why you don't believe me, because I've bought quite a lot of stupid shit, and she basically rolls her eyes at all of it, apart from this. So I found, and she actually said, however much you paid for it, it was worth it. So maybe anything Godzilla is the way forward here. But we're really tight for cash at the moment, so I'm really glad that was a response, because I bought this like a day before. We had a big financial kind of, okay, we need to pull on the drawstrings. And then, like, in my head, I'm like, oh, should I cancel my eBay order? But it was fine. It was all fine. I bought it. I sold my Steam Deck to buy an OLED Steam Deck, and I've used some of the money to buy that. So it's not really in-play money. All of my other money goes to bills and stuff, apart from this little stockpile I've got. So it just means the Steam Deck is going to be a little bit longer.
I mean,
but it's ridiculously cool. I don't see a Steam Deck making me as happy. I took a video of laughing uncontrollably at this thing. I sent to Matt immediately because I couldn't stop laughing at this thing. And it's nice to hear myself. It's nice to hear me happy at a giant walking, growling, steam-breathing Godzilla.
Highly, I mean, recommend. Yeah. That's It's definitely a thing. And I'm going to say that I am jealous that you have it. So
yes. You should buy the Pip-Boy.
I can't. I officially cannot afford that right now for various reasons.
Yes.
But I have plenty of other stupid shit that I own now. So anyway. Well, I'm glad you have a fun, happy toy. And I'm glad that your wife... this figment of your imagination has given you a blessing, whilst your real wife rolls her eyes in the
That's true. I do have.
Like, yes. I'm pretty sure you've had some kind of break with reality over this. So until I see your wife and she tells me free of duress that she endorses this purchase, I'm just not going to believe you. I'm sorry.
What a way to go! Absolutely, with Godzilla.
Right. Yeah.
What is the stupidest thing you've bought? And when I say stupidest, it's like the very example of I have adult money and I don't care. and it's completely impractical and probably overpriced, but it made you as happy as I was with that Godzilla. Like, what thing did you buy that was your version?
It's going to be either... I mean, there's a lot of options. I own two Nerf rifles, one of which is an the pulse rifle from Aliens, and one of which is a Type 2 phaser rifle from Star Trek. I do not have children or anyone to play Nerf games with. I just own these two Nerf guns now. I own a Star Trek three-dimensional chess set, which I've never used. I own a Star Trek Bluetooth, original series Bluetooth communicator, which is an accessory for my phone that I never use. But it's, to be fair, it's cool as hell. I wish it was a better speaker. I would use it more frequently if it was a better speaker. But it's just a very expensive Bluetooth speaker. Like, it's not. Mm-hmm. It's an overpriced Bluetooth speaker because, to be fair, it's very nice. It's very well made. It charges inductively. Has a nice little stand. It makes sounds from the show, but it's pretty dumb. So yeah, those would be the dumbest things that I own. I mean, I also have a Big Lebowski bowling ball cleaning chamois. That's useful because I use it to clean my glasses like every day.
There we are, practical use. You can't argue with that.
And I've also owned it since the Big Lebowski came out on limited collector's edition DVD in like 2005 or some shit. So it's not, it's just a 20-year-old purchase and I still use it every day.
See, you can't say that about your digital media purchases, can you, in 20 years, that you got a chamois with your Apple TV order or something.
Yeah. I do have a Klingon Batleth as well, but that was a wedding present, so I don't know if that really counts.
That was a key part of your wedding ceremony, which I kind of adored, the Batleth section of your speeches.
Yeah, I mean, that's
pretty great.
What you got to do. You got to have you got to tell the story of the first Klingon hearts. it's just how weddings are supposed to work. That's a traditional part of the wedding, right?
Right. Isn't someone meant to kill someone immediately afterwards, though? Surely that should be part of any Klingon ceremony.
No, I think you spill blood and mix it together, though.
Oh, oh, okay. Of course.
Yeah.
Good. Well, what should we talk about this week, then? What do you want to start with?
Well, we're going to talk about two films this week. We're going to talk about the new Zack Snyder Rebel Moon Part 2, The Scar Giver, which I swear to God is the accurate title for that film. And then we're going to talk about Alex Garland's Civil War. Before we leap into that, I would like to just point out, which I always fail to do, but we do... For those of you who are interested, we do have a Patreon, and if you do subscribe to the Patreon, you do get a bonus episode every week, usually around a half hour long, and this week we talked about a series of pop culture hot takes that I have, and I thought Simon's reactions to them were pretty interesting. 100%
worth. You probably, like, start subscribing this month so you can hear that episode, because there are so many opinions. It's wonderful.
It's... I mean, most of them are pretty lukewarm takes, I would say. But a couple of them are pretty hot. A couple of them are pretty cold. But most of them are just, I think pretty lukewarm. But let's dive into it. I think we're going to talk about Rebel Moon,
yes.
Part 2, The Scar Giver, to start. And this is Part 2 of Zack Snyder's ongoing Rebel Moon franchise. Can you give us the lowdown on the plot? Give us the lowdown on the plot of this movie, because I don't think I can. I'm just going to say it's the third act.
Yes,
it's the third act of Seven Samurai extended to a full 2.25 hours.
So if you've seen the first Rebel Moon, you have my condolences. This is somehow worse.
Interesting. I would say that it's actually better, but...
Well, I mean, the bar. Where is the bar in this case? We're probably both correct. Like, there's some kind of fourth dimension where we can both be correct here.
I'll tell you that the bar is so low that I don't know anyone who could limbo under it.
Yes. The whole plot of this movie is the third act. They... The, the beginning of the movie, Cora goes back to the farm planet that she started at to tell everyone, hey, we've won. The guy who's threatening us is dead. And then within maybe a minute and a half, they work out that he's not dead and he's still coming. Like, everyone's still coming. And so they basically have to prepare for invasion, and they've got 5 days to prepare for this invasion. And then there's the invasion, and then there's the end of the movie. That is the entire plot of this film, is getting ready for the invasion that was not averted. They've got the gang together. We still don't really know who these people are. The wonderful thing is that this film begins with a very meaningful Anthony Hopkins voiceover in his beautiful Welsh brogue, recapping the events of the first movie, and I didn't remember any of it. Like, everything he was describing could have been brand new information to me, even though I saw the movie quite recently. And that's one of the myriad of problems here, is that we don't know who these people are at all on any level. And so there's an obscene amount of slow motion, including 4 or 5 wheat collection scenes, which sounds as exciting as they are. And then they prepare for battle, and there's lots of, if you ask an AI to write a motivating war speech, there's lots of those. And there's lots of very clunky emotional dialogue. And there's lots of very TV level CG. And then it ends. This film is almost completely inconsequential to anything. Like, it is literally the third act of this movie, but it, unlike The Seven Samurai and unlike The Magnificent Seven, you have no idea who these people are. They have almost zero character development apart from Cora, and even hers is pretty terrible. There's one scene where I think there's 4 slow motion flashbacks in one scene as they're sat around a table comparing their own personal trauma, which is Monty Python-esque in its ridiculousness. You think that's bad? I had to walk 4 days over a coal field eating nothing but grass.
And I was dead at the time.
The whole focus of this movie has a female protagonist, and spoiler, she's saved by a dude at the end. I feel like Zack Snyder has completely forgotten the audience experience, like the experience of watching the movie. The film director has to know what the audience is watching, and I think he's just completely abandoned any idea of what you want when you watch a movie, because I don't understand why this film even exists.
I mean, I would say, to answer a couple of your points, but the main one is that, like the protagonist is female, but that doesn't matter, which is a double-edged sword, because on the one hand, like, of course it doesn't matter, but on the other hand, like, it doesn't matter that she's been saved because she's asexual. Like, Zack Snyder does not have... His movies are either inappropriately horny or the most sexless things you've ever seen, and this falls into the latter category, even though there's a sex scene, which they skip over, like, immediately. And, like, the scene would be the same if it was 2 dudes, or if it was 2 women, or if the roles were... It wouldn't matter, because there's just no anything about it that is of any consequence. And I'm saying that as someone who likes the 2 actors we're talking about, which are Michael Huisman and Sofia Boutella. I think they're both really great normally. And I don't think they're bad here exactly. I think they have nothing to work with, but I don't think they're bad. I don't know. I think this one's better than the first one because, you know, it's not burdened with as much exposition. And it just gets down to the stuff that Zack Snyder is very clearly interested in, which is the big fight at the end. And, I mean, that's kind of... It's so nothing. It's a nothing movie. And then it ends on a ridiculous, like, cliff... like, a ridiculous sequel bait that comes out of nowhere. Apparently he wants to make 6 of them. And yeah. I don't... And, like... this isn't an old joke at this point, but like I think we probably made it when we talked about the first one, that like if you just played the slow-mo at regular speed, this movie would be half as long.
Then if you
did that with both movies and then edited them together, it would be one perfectly serviceable, not great, but perfectly serviceable Seven Samurai ripoff. And that would be fine. But it's just not that. It's just all indulgent bullshit.
It's so indulgent.
And there's like, there's things about it that I like, but I think I could probably count them on one hand. You were about to say something though.
No, I was just thinking about how indulgent and how it is and how badly written it is, really. Like, there's one wonderful moment. This is called The Scar Giver, which is Sophia Boutella's nickname for her character. And Ed Skrein is playing the baddie, and he has a scar on his chest that she gave him in the first movie, and the commandant says, "Sorry about the scar, sir, we can remove it." And he says, "No, leave the scar. She gave it to me." And I think I texted you immediately, like, for Jesus wept. Like, there's someone on Letterboxd said, and I really agree with this, if you had told me this was entirely written and directed by an AI, I would believe you, because it's exactly how it sounds. And even good actors like Jimon Hounsou and Sophia Boutella, who's really good, like, nobody can save this. Nobody is good in this film. In fact, I would say everyone is bad in this film, because they have nothing to work with whatsoever. It's really poorly written and poorly directed and poorly made. It's just a nothing film. There's nothing here at all.
I feel like the performers are all doing, like, none of it is their fault, I guess, is where I would go with this. That, like,
yes.
I think that they're all doing the best they can with what they have, and none of them are, if they're bad, it's because the words they're saying are bad. Like, it's not, I think they're doing whatever they can with, again, what little they're given. I think that Sophia Boutella is fine. I think that Michael Huisman is fine. I think that Jimon Hounsou does everything he can with his ridiculous level of backstory. I think that Ed Skrein, at least, understands the movie he's in and dials it to 12 at all times, and that is kind of what the film needs.
Mm-hmm.
I think if the film fails anyone, it's probably Bay Duna. Because her character is given this whole like connection to the village, and then when she tries, sorry, spoiler alert, but you know, it's Seven Samurai, you know that at least four of them are going to die. So when her character like dies, it's treated with all of this weight that it has not earned, like, at all. And if they had just like shot those scenes at regular speed and fleshed them out a little more, maybe it would work, but it doesn't. It just doesn't.
Do you know what?
There's things here that I like, though. Like, there's got to be. Is there anything about this film that you like? Because I can name a couple things that I liked. I like that all of the technology is either, some of it is directly lifted from Star Wars, and some of it is just World War II stuff in the future.
Yeah, it's like submarine, isn't it?
Like, the big ship is a submarine, and they point the big gun with, like, manual turn dials rather than, like, a computer screen or a hologram. Like, I like that a lot of the technology is obviously super advanced, but with really weird analog controls, you know? And that's a double-edged sword, too, though, because for every moment of that's cool, they also have a scene where, like, they have to bring in the harvest, which normally takes weeks. They have to bring it in 3 days, and they have, like, they have hover carts, but they don't have mechanized harvesting tools. It's sort of weird, right? Like,
definitely.
And I would actually argue that, like, when you say the CG is TV level, I would disagree. I think a lot of it is very solid. I don't think that the movie is very good, but, like, I don't think the CG is the problem here. And in particular, there's the character that Anthony Hopkins voices over, who's this, like, robot who wears a crown of antlers and speaks philosophically about his, you know, forgotten purposes in life. That character looks like, that robot looks real to me, except when it's moving in an unreal way, which it does occasionally when it's fighting. But that robot looks real when it's standing there and talking to people. It looks real. So like there's, if you just want to watch like an empty, and if you just want to watch an empty spectacle, like I've seen worse when it comes to that. But not by much, I guess. It's the other side of that coin, right? Like it's fine. I would say this again, I would say this one is better than the first one, but only because this is the one that has all the stuff that Snyder is, whether or not he's, I would say, even interested in more, but also he's better at executing. Like he's better at executing the big fight than he is at any kind of like character development. So I don't know, do with that what you will.
I was fascinated at his overuse of slow-mo and linking back to what I was saying earlier about him forgetting the audience experience and how much the slow motion dilutes any kind of tension or emotional connection to any of the action happening. And there's one really good example of this where he has a lightsaber fight, because of course he does, and he uses normal speed to go into the lightsaber fight, and then as soon as it starts, it goes into like half speed, slow motion. And it really reminded me of one of my favorite bits of The Last Jedi, where just before the throne room fight, with a great bit of John Williams' score as well, Rian Johnson uses slow-mo at the beginning of the fight as they dial up, and then snaps into normal speed on the first hit, on the first hit, which is one of my all-time favorite Star Wars moments that I watch over and over again. And it really hammered home to me how much he doesn't understand how to tell, how to use pacing in the way he's telling a story. Because the fights in Scargiver were completely inconsequential. They were there's no connection or tension because you can see every single thing at half speed. And to have that direct comparison of the use of slow-mo in a lightsaber battle and how it was used so effectively the other way around really underlined to me how I felt about what he does visually. I think the best thing he could do, I think, for me, is just to be a cinematographer for a while. Like, have somebody else's script and have someone else directing and just make it look good. Because he's a visual, all of his stuff has been visually, like, interesting, and I think some of his design choices are interesting. And he, for a while there, he was one of my favorite directors, so I just wish he would kind of find that again. And I don't know if the whole Justice League thing burned him out, and of course he had terrible family tragedy at the time, so it's really difficult for me to sort of judge how that has impacted him. But I would love for him to find a bit of the energy that he used to have again.
So, you know what I mean? What I was going to say is that, like, you say all that, but I would counterpoint that for me, and if memory serves, we agreed at the time, but, like, Army of the Dead is exactly the right speed for him. And that came before this, right? Like, I found that Army of the Dead was his best film in ages. Mm-hmm. And so I felt like he sort of found it and then lost it again, like or maybe he just overindulged, like, in his own, maybe he drank his own Kool-Aid or something, but like I still like Army of the Dead. I think it's totally fine film, not great, but not bad, not terrible, and at least knows, you know, it's better at deploying slow-mo a little more judiciously. It's better at building up all of its characters than either of these two movies. It's better at everything. It's a far more competent film, and I feel like I kind of wish he'd kept going with that instead of with this. Like,
100%.
And I will say that, like, I know we talked about this before, and I'm not saying it's a good answer, but I do appreciate, at least recently, he was asked, like, why do you use so much slow-mo? And he basically said, because it looks cool. And, like, just to be clear, that is not a great answer. It's not an answer that illuminates anything about, like, his storytelling choices. But I do appreciate that there's a very simple purity there of him saying, like, I just like it, so I'm going to keep fucking doing it. Is like, I'm sort of on board with that kind of answers a lot of the time. But yeah, I mean, just to get back on point, like, this is not a great movie. Like, I'm saying it's better than the first one, and I'm giving it the same number of stars as I gave the first one, but like it's better than the first one for me. But unlike other films that came in two parts recently, I cannot imagine ever watching either of these again.
Dude wants to be Villeneuve so bad, doesn't he? Like this, he wants to be considered in the same tone and seriousness as Villeneuve and
Spielberg, Lucas,
Spielberg, and Scott as well. Like he has aspirations, especially with Dune coming out so recently, and he's becoming more Paul W.S. Anderson than anything, and that's sad as well.
I'm going to disagree with you there, because at least Paul W.S. Anderson seems to be having a good time making movies.
That's true.
I can't say that for sure, but like Paul W.S. Anderson is married to one of the most beautiful people on the planet, and he keeps having the best time of his life, effectively just making her look awesome. And I'm sort of down with that, you know, like
intentionally, that's a good point actually, because he does intentionally make shit like schlock, I should say. Like I'm convinced Paul W.S. Anderson keeps getting money because he makes things quick, he makes them brash, and he makes them under budget. That's hugely attractive to film producers and filmmakers. And he's got Milla Jovovich like connected to any project he wants to do. So yeah, that's a good point. I think he doesn't have the kind of delusional aspirations that that Snyder has. And Snyder having a cult following, I'm sure doesn't help as well with his own sort of opinion of himself.
No, I'm 100% sure that it does not. But I don't know, like, you can see the competencies there when you watch this, and then when they don't flesh out or, like, reach their potential, it just becomes frustrating. And I don't know, I feel like there's only, because he's so singular, and because he's an auteur, and because he's credited as the director and the writer and all of these things on this film, I almost wish there was someone else to blame, you know, like, you know, someone there to be like, that swayed him in the wrong direction. But at the end of the day, it's just him, and that's a disappointment. Yeah. I don't know. It's a whole thing. I was very let down by this movie. I try to approach every movie as, you know, I try not to prejudge. This one was not good. I will say, at least, you know, Junkie XL wrote the score. The score's good. The score's fun. It's a lot of slow notes to keep up with all the slow-mo, but it's not a bad score. He makes good music. I don't know. How many stars are you landing on for this? Is it one or two for you?
It's one. Just like the first one, it's one star because of the chunky... I like the device design I liked. That's it. That's my only star.
Did you only give the first one one? I thought you gave it two.
Yeah. No, I gave the first one one.
I think I gave it two, and I think I'm giving this one two as well. It would have to be a lot. Like, I know it takes a lot for me to get all the way down to one. And this does not get there. But it's not great, you know? Like, it's just, you know, I don't know, man. I wish it was better.
Another thing that stood out for me is just the editing is really bad. The editing, I don't know if you noticed this, but a lot of the editing was maybe two or three frames late. And so there was...
No, I just chalked that up to the same slow-mo bullshit. Yeah. That,
but it made the slow-mo even worse. But anyway. Yeah, one star. Can't really say I recommend it. Apparently, he wants to make six and each with two... like part ones and part two. So three and four will be one story and five and six will be one story. But I would be very interested to hear the conversations going on in Netflix at the moment about whether they're going to fund that and what's going to happen. He's already talking about the versions on Netflix are not his desired version, and he's got director's cuts that are longer of each film. And boy, howdy, I wish he'd cut that shit out as well.
That's sure. I don't know. The best response to that is that like Netflix or some account posted that like there's a longer, better version of Sucker Punch that he'd like to release, and like the screenshotted response that's going around social media like wildfire right now is someone responding and being like, "Dude, just make your movies good in the first place."
Sucker Punch like, is no one thought like that had a full release. At least you can see Netflix saying, well, this is streaming on, so you can't have blood, because there's a huge, like, the absence of blood in these movies. He's designed them for like these dramatic takedowns that you never see, so you can kind of see like Netflix leaned on him a bit for that. But Sucker Punch had a full theatrical release. He could do whatever he wanted with that film because he was riding high at that time. I filmed a massive chunk of Sucker Punch that wasn't in the final cut that he decided to cut out, which I thought was fascinating and really interesting. So that's on him.
Yeah. I don't get it. I still don't get it. I wish he would figure his shit out. So
yes.
That's 1 star from you and 2 stars from me, and that's all we need to say about it.
Yes.
Let's move on. Something a little better. We're going to talk about Alex Garland's Civil War. This film's been up for a couple of weeks. If you haven't already seen it, I highly suggest you do so in a theater. It's quite an experience. But the basic thought setup for this movie is that the United States has erupted into a civil war. There's at least 3 factions. There's the government, the authoritarian government led by President Nick Offerman. There is the Western forces, which are Texas and California. And then there's the Florida Alliance, which is a number of states, not given as much attention, but a number of states in the southeast of the United States. And Kirsten Dunst and Wagner Moura and Stephen Henderson and Kaylee Spaney are a team of journalists who are traveling from New York to Washington, D.C. to try to get an interview with the president before the war comes to an end. The war has been raging for an unknown amount of time, and it's winding down as the Western forces encroach upon Washington, D.C. And the film is basically a road trip movie through what America would be like if it was in a civil war. I have already written a review of this film. I wrote for Real, I think. And so I'll find that and link it in the show notes. But I think that it is a cogent and important and timely film. And I think that everybody in the States should probably watch it. I think anyone who lives in a country like the States, or to a lesser degree, Canada, but maybe like Brazil, should definitely see it. And my biggest complaint about it is that the kind of people who... The people who need to see it the most are A, the least likely to see it, and B, the least likely to understand what it's trying to tell them. But I think that's sort of true of this kind of film regardless. This is a film with a strong anti-war message. This is a film with a strong, this is what journalism is and should be type message. And also... My main takeaway from this film has been, and I've been thinking about it a lot since I first saw it, but my main takeaway from this film is that it is a warning to literally anyone who's ever thought, and apparently 1 in 5 Americans think this, that violence is the answer, that like there might need to be a new revolution, there might need to be a new civil war to solve whatever societal problems are facing any particular person. And this movie is a very stark warning to anyone who's ever had that thought, that this is what you're asking for. The brutality, the division, the irreparable damage to not just the property and like the buildings and all of that in the United States, but to the social fabric of America, or any country that chose to go into a, that were chose, but any country that devolved into a civil war. Mm-hmm. This film shows that that damage is catastrophic and irreparable. And it it does a very, very good job of highlighting that. There are people in the world who will tell you that this film is apolitical. They are incorrect. The journalists don't take a side. The journalists, from the very beginning, explicitly say they're going to be doing journalism, which means they don't decide. They document so that others can decide. But that is not to say the film is apolitical. This is a film that features an authoritarian president. He's unnamed, and it's I can see why some people who aren't paying attention might think that, like, oh, he's just a president. But, like, and he, to be fair, he's not Trump, but he is clearly an authoritarian, strongman, cult of personality in his third term, who has let, you know, he's the guy, he's the reason they're at war. And then every time they encounter a new set of soldiers, there's a war crime happening. And by the time they link up with the forces, the big third act is them linking up with the Western forces, assaulting the White House. And they just, on their way through the White House, do a couple of war crimes very casually. So there's no real good guys. And I'm sure the Western forces are ostensibly the good guys in the film, but they are doing bad things as well. Like, this film is, I cannot stress enough, is a warning to anyone who has ever fantasized about taking up arms, about what that actually looks like. And I'm kind of rambling at the moment, but I just want to keep going because I can't stop. It's been a couple of weeks since I've seen this film and I have not stopped thinking about it. And this is all before I get into the fact that literally everyone in it is excellent. There are no bad performances. Kirsten Dunst as the jaded, experienced reporter, photojournalist, is excellent. And Kaylee Spani, who I'm so excited to see taking on more and more roles and getting bigger and bigger roles, is so good as the wide-eyed, naive newcomer. And her arc from that to hardened journalist is incredible to watch. You have Stephen McKinley Henderson, doesn't have a ton to do as the, like, elder statesman journalist, except dispense, you know, sage advice. But he's so good at that that, like, who cares? He's one of the best in the business at that. And then you have Wagner Moura, who is the thrill-seeking, adrenaline junkie reporter who's looking to do the interview. And his arc from, like, gung-ho, let's go into this war zone, to, like, holy shit, we're in a war zone, is also something else to behold. And that's before we talk about Jesse Plemons, who just walks into the movie and steals it with one scene. And he wasn't even supposed to be there that day. He wasn't originally cast in that part. But it's the scene you've seen in the trailer where he's asking, you know, what kind of American are you? It's a chilling, chilling scene. This is going to go down as one of my best films of the year, like, almost certainly. And I can't wait till I get the opportunity to see it again. My wife went and saw it in a cinema after I did, because I saw it at a press screening. And I kind of wish that I had blown off work and gone with her, because I very much want to see it again. But I've been going on for a long time. So, how did you feel about Civil War, Simon?
Well, it's an incredibly powerful movie. In the things that the side of the story that it decides to focus on. So the impartiality of journalism, the dehumanizing nature of war for the journalists and for the soldiers. Kirsten Dunst is incredible. Over everyone is Kaylee Spenny, who I've been following for a couple of years, is just, like you say, getting better and better. And I need to watch Priscilla now because she's just an incredible actor.
Spoiler alert, she's really good in Devs, too.
Ah, that's another person I should watch in Devs. Okay. So I really like Alex Garland as a filmmaker a lot. Men didn't really land with me, but all of the other ones really, really have. And, I found it more of a mixed bag, in that so it's a film that is stubbornly impartial to show the impartiality of journalism, and I'm not sure that gives us the depth, or I'm not sure it really has the luxury of being so impartial when you've got, for the most part, and it's clearly from the opening scene, the way Nick Offerman's first lines are written, it's very clearly a clear Trump analogy. You've got one side primarily fighting foreigners and people of color, and you've got another side with women and people of color, like, against those people. So it's, I think I would have found it a more interesting, not interesting is the right word, more balanced if there wasn't so clearly one side who are anti, like, everything that isn't white American or even certain states. This film never ever doesn't judge anyone. And when you join up with the Western forces, and you mentioned they storm the Capitol and they do horrific things, and really it's that culmin, the last half an hour, say, pretty unbelievable. Sorry, in a good way. I'm trying to not use the word spectacular because it's devastating, but this whole film, I think, has one of the best sound designs I've heard in a film in recent years. And that last, that the way Garland uses sound has always really, really got to me. And this movie is no exception at all. And it builds to something. And when it does release into that something, it's incredible. Like, how he gets across the trauma of what they're going through. And Kirsten Dunst being jaded and then being finally, like, her humanity and terror coming through and really being a major part of the climax is an interesting part of the story, especially as so many of the other journalists don't share the same humanity that she does. There's a couple of moments where the journalists are as cold as any of the soldiers when it comes to what they're doing. And I think that's a major part of the movie as well, is the obsession with telling the story from an impartial viewpoint in many parts of this movie overrides what should be a human reaction to the situation they're in, and paints them in a pretty bad picture, particularly Cole Glissman's character. And it's in, like, having Kelly Spaney as that the younger parallel at the beginning of her career, who so idolizes Kirsten Dunst, Lee Smith, I thought was a really interesting parallel, and she plays a major part in that as well. But I think what I'm trying to say is that I think it could have been a bit more judgmental, in rather than just being purely trying to be objective as the photojournalist, which is one of the main parts of the film that it wants to be, is be this, like, as purely objective as possible. But I think one of the most dangerous things in politics is this idea that both sides should be heard. And when you've got one side shooting colored people, shooting people from the wrong states, shooting anyone that doesn't look like them or act like them, and the other side fighting against that, I think that's an element that should be commented on. And up until the very end of the movie, the other forces, the Western forces, aren't displayed as doing the same kind of evil, barbaric kind of behavior as the president supporting people. And I think not referencing that, or not using that in the story, or not judging that in any way, is perhaps wrong. Is any of this making sense?
No, so it is, but I'm going to say that I think that's a pretty common take that I happen to disagree with. Because I think that the film... it's a pretty common argument that the film is maybe too objective, and that it should pass judgment on the people that are being documented. But I would counterpoint that the film is allowing us the opportunity to make that judgment, because it's very clear who the good guys are and who the bad guys are. And I do say that, like, the Western forces do a couple war crimes along the way, but they are very clearly the good guys. Like, and the war crimes they do are, like, they shoot an unarmed combatant twice. You know, like, they are otherwise, they are fighting against people fighting back. And I think that it introduces a human. There's a thing that happens in the climax that I think it's all, it shows people getting caught up in the moment in a way that is, I think, believable. But I don't think at any point, I don't think it's not judgmental, is what I'm trying to say. I think that it is showing you a world that allows you to judge. I think it shows you the way that, like, journalism is supposed to operate that way. And, you know, you say that the journalists are cold in the way that some of the soldiers are, but, like, they're not. Because you have Kaylee Spanning at the beginning, who's young and naive and barely able to keep her shit together on this arc towards becoming like her idol, Lee Smith, who's cold and calculated and just, I'm going to get the shot, who goes on the opposite journey from, like, being that at the beginning, but maybe in a little bit denial about how much she is able to be that, and by the end, having that facade completely break. And even Wagner Moura, whose character at the beginning is, like, gung-ho to go to war, and then realizing what he's working through. And I think the scene with Jesse Plemons as the war crime committing soldier, who's clearly going to kill them if they don't escape, is the turning point for sort of everybody. Because Wagner Moura at the beginning of the film is like, I want to sit down and have a conversation. And at the end, that is not what happens. Even a little bit. Like, they've all clearly made their choices. And I think that you don't need to ask the film to make its own judgment when all the characters have, and when it's given you enough information to make your own. And I think that that is I think it's important. I think that a lot of media these days, especially, spoon feeds you what you're meant to think. And this film gives you the information to make a decision for yourself. And it's a pretty easy decision to make, but it is asking you to make it rather than just being like, here's the choice. Like, here's what you need to think about this. It's saying, what do you think? I've made a pretty clear argument, but what do you think is my opinion. And I think it works really, really, really well, actually. But I think it's just so outside the norm these days. I think so many things are unambiguous that we are sort of used to being sort of spoon-fed the ideas. And I think that that is a mistake. I think this film is, I'm going to use the word important again. I think the film is very important in that way.
Interesting take. I'm not sure I agree totally, but it's an interesting take on it. I think the of course, all opinions are subjective, aren't they? And I think this film really is going to, you're going to feel one way or the other about how this film deals with the Trumpism on display. And especially as in America, one thing that I find the most infuriating is the lack of judgment of that side of America, or the lack of pushback. Like, Trump has discovered that words are fast and policy is slow, so he can say and do what he wants, and then the whole legal system, which is that the whole presidency is built on the president will probably act with obeying the rules and with some kind of internal, like, honor or logic to what they're trying to do. And there's that leaves massive loopholes for someone like Trump, who can mobilize this horrifically violent, racist side of America and give it, and fan the flames and give it strength and spearhead an insurrection and still not be in jail for it. I would personally have liked a bit more fingers pointed at that being unacceptable. As very clearly in the film, they are the bad side. They are the wrong side. And I think that the film could have gone into that with a bit more depth, personally. But I think the reflection that you feel after that film, after watching this, and it has a very impactful last moment as well. It's certainly going to intentionally divide opinion. I also, on the flip side, I think it's a really interesting examination of objectivity as a job in these terrible situations. but being so objective and so obsessed with being there for the story, like at the beginning, that they just want to get there before he's killed because they want an interview. And like the dehumanizing idea of all of this, I think that was a really interesting element. But the political side, I don't think was had the depth or the teeth that it really needed to be satisfying for me. But that's just my take.
Yeah, I mean, again, it's a pretty common take. I guess for me, my opinion is that, like, they started a civil war over it. I'm not sure how many more fingers can be pointed. You know, like it's anyway, it's certainly going to divide and has so far divided audiences. But I think that there's no denying the, like, the craft and thought that has been put into it. Right. Like, sure. It is an exceedingly well-made movie. It is an exceedingly well-acted movie. I think that the writing, especially just the conversations, like in the lull points between the various, like, battles and things they encounter, the conversations they have are deep and meaningful and affecting in ways that will keep you thinking well after the fact. And I think that, like, what we're talking about, like, this division in our opinion, although I think we both think it's a good film, I think is at least part of the point. Like, I know that Alex Garland has been on record saying that, like, you know, there's a lot of people out there who are like, California and Texas joining together in one, like, you're certainly crazy. And he's like, I'm making a comment on partisan politics. And if you're saying that there's nothing bad enough that could have happened that would allow these two states to put their shit aside and work together, then what does that say about your take on politics? Like, what, like, that is part of the comment, right? And I think that the film is designed to spur these conversations, to spur these reactions, so that we might examine things a little more closely. Because I think that, like, I don't personally think America is going to devolve into a civil war. At least I hope not. But, like, these are the conversations that will need to be had if they want to avoid it, you know? Like, so I think it's a pretty important and, again, timely piece of art. And I hope that, you know, it's springtime right now, which is never the best time for an awards contender. But I sincerely hope that the Academy and Globes and all of those things remember Kirsten Dunst when the time comes, because she is truly spectacular in this film.
Yeah. And, yeah, she is incredible.
And it's been a while since I've seen her in a lead performance, really. And she's really, like, bringing her A game here in a way that she's always been sort of great. She's been working since she was a child, and she's always been great. And this is just on another level, on another level good.
Yeah. There's when she, what's the right word? When something breaks in her, the way she conveys that together with the sound design is utterly, utterly, like, gut-wrenching. And she's incredible. And from a technical perspective, it is a brilliantly made film. And also, Alex Garland's a fantastic writer. And if you want to learn about script writing, if that's something you're doing, then watch Scargiver and then watch this movie, like I did. Do a 1-2, because there's one point in Scargiver where two people arrive and the two people walk up and immediately walk into frame and introduce themselves and who they are in the context, which is just terrible writing. And what Civil War is a great demonstration of is how to get all the work in, but have it written so naturally that it's part of conversation, that you learn it through how they naturally interact with each other. There's some great, great lines in this. Like, there's one point where Kelly Spelling gets out of the car and the friendly old guy, what's his name?
Oh, Stephen Henderson.
Stephen Henderson's like, be careful, keep your head down. And she's like, yeah, no shit. And just goes. Like, it's really clever writing all the way through. And a lot of it, good writing is the character listening to other people and responding to it rather than just sprouting words. And it's a great demonstration of that.
Yeah, there's a great scene in the middle, a scene that I think about a lot, actually, where they're driving through a Christmas market and somebody starts shooting at them. And so they have to get out of the car and they happen upon a sniper and his spotter. And Wagner Moura's character is like, "Hey, what's going on here?" And the spotter's like, "Somebody's shooting at us." Like, and it's just so like perfect and on the nose. And he's like, "Yeah, but like, like which side, like who are they? Like, which side are they?" And he's like, "They're the side that is shooting at us." Like,
yeah,
it's a really great illustration of like, of, again, just like the horrors and the uncertainty of like what it would actually mean to be at war and how things really, really do come down to that base level of like we're not fighting for a side here. We are shooting so that we don't get shot, you know, like, and that is where things would have inevitably go. And the whole thing is great. And again, the scene with Jesse Plemons where, you know, they're like, "Oh, there's a confusion here. We're American." And he's like, "Oh yeah. What kind of American?" Like that line, like it's a great line in the trailer and it is a absolutely chilling line in context in the movie when you know what's going on around it. And it's so well written and so well performed that I hope that everybody remembers it come the fall or come the new year.
So Jesse Plemons wasn't meant to be that role, you were saying?
No, so it was a story that came out on social media just a week or two ago, actually, that like they had somebody cast in that role and they didn't say why, but that person had to drop out. And they, at this point, Alex Garland like was going to the cast and he was like, "Look, the person we had to play this soldier, and we're like about to start filming this scene. Like literally this is like the day or 2 days before they were supposed to film this scene. This guy drops out." And he said, "Look, this person dropped out and I don't know what we're going to do." And after some discussion, apparently Kirsten Dunst was just like, "Well, how about I just ask Jesse?" Cause they're married. Right. Mm-hmm. And she was like, "He's already read the script. Like, he helped me run lines. Like, why don't I just see if Jesse can do it?" And apparently the next day he was just on set, like, as a favor. So yeah, he literally just, like, waltzed on set, filmed the best scene in the movie, and then just left.
That's his superpower, isn't he?
Yeah. And I think it was just sort of, like, you know, kismet, because also, like, again, like, he'd already read the script. He already had familiarity with Alex Garland. He was available. Like, it just sort of worked out. But it's one of those stories where you're, like, imagine if it was anyone else at this point. Like, you just can't. He's so good at delivering, showing up in for like a small portion of a movie and stealing the whole thing. And it's interesting how his career has progressed. Because I used to just think of him as like discount Matt Damon, but now he's one of the most exciting actors on the planet.
Sure. Do you know who the actor was who dropped out?
They never said. Right. At least not that I've seen, they never said.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's, yeah. A lovely moment of things coming together, and it helps when your leading lady is married to Jesse Plemons.
Yeah, and they've actually not been together very long, but they seem like a really happy and well-adjusted couple, yeah, which is nice. Like them and what's his name? Like, it's like them, and then it's Sam Rockwell and his wife Leslie Bibb are like the two most well-adjusted couples in Hollywood, and I feel like people should aspire to that. Well, I guess technically Nick Offerman and his wife are also well adjusted, but yeah. Anyway,
how many stars for you?
So for me right now, it's still a 4, with the caveat that like once I get a chance to actually see it again, it might go up. But 4 for me, it's for sure. It's at least a 4. Like there's, it's too well made and too well written to be anything other than a 4. And you know, I saw this movie and wrote about it 2+ weeks ago, at least. I saw it when it was before it came out, and I have been thinking about it nonstop since, which again is a surefire sign of a 4-star movie.
So I don't agree. It's a 3-star for me. It is brilliantly made. I just I wasn't as satisfied with how it said what it said and what it didn't say than as much as you. So it's a 3-star for me. Kind of conflicted about this film. Yeah.
Fair enough. It might be one. And part of the reason I say it might go up when I see it again is that I do feel like it's a film that will probably reward multiple watching if you can stomach watching it more than once.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I will say too that like your theatrical experience may, I think this movie probably, well, maybe not. I don't know. A lot of the people, the crowd of people that I, the crowd, the like six people I saw it with, are also pretty divided on it. So, and we all saw it in the same cinema. So, I think it exists to be divisive though. So I think it's accomplishing its goal.
Sure.
Yeah.
You should definitely go see it though. Out of the two movies we've talked about this week, like make time to see this film.
Oh yeah. 100%. Like there's, if you want to put something on in the background and not watch it, then sure, maybe think about Rebel Moon. If you want to actually watch
what a film, an endorsement.
Yeah, if you actually want to watch a film, then watch Civil War.
Yes.
And that'll be that. Anyway, well, let's wrap it up there. We're at our usual runtime of an hour, and I think that's been pretty good conversation. So if you're listening to this, thank you so much for listening. One more time, if you've enjoyed the conversation, if you like the way we banter, consider supporting our Patreon. It's as little as $2 a month, Canadian, and you get at least an extra half hour of talk every week. This week, again, we talked about a number of lukewarm takes of mine, and I thought it was really interesting. You can also help us out a little less directly by smashing that like button or subscribing on your podcasting platform of choice or giving us a 5-star review on your podcasting platform of choice. Those are the things that get us in front of more earballs, and we would appreciate you forever for it. If you'd like to catch up with us, tell us what you thought of either movie. You can follow me on the social medias. I am at SmathewAF in most places. But you can find the show at awesomefriday.ca. You can find Simon at his homepage, temporarypen.com. And you can find me and all my socials at my homepage, stretched.ca. And we would love to hear from you. Last but not least, we are located here in Vancouver on the unceded and ancestral territory of the Musqueam, Tsleil-Waututh, and Squamish Nations. And that is it for us this week. Thank you again so much for listening on this awesome Friday.
Thanks, bye.